that perhaps, I don't know, 50 or so years ago, before cell phones and these kind of things, the talk of the town was the regular phone that everybody had in their house. And it was quite normal to be memorizing telephone numbers. Yet, this is a conversation, for example, of that era. But in this era, we find that if a conversation revolves around modern technology, it's going to be a smartphone or a chip phone or whatever kind of phone is out there that's on the market, and that's what people really will be talking about. And interestingly, nobody memorizes telephone numbers anymore. Now, when we look at the conversations of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam and the people that are asking him questions and the kind of questions that they are asking him, we really get an interesting insight into what exactly was going on in their era. Now, one of the things, of course, which was quite prevalent during the eras of the Imams, and more so, even though right from the beginning, right from Imam Ali alayhi salam's time, this was an issue, but the farther we go from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam being a center point, being a start point, the farther we go from that start point, the farther we become from that start point. And so here, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he says that nothing destroys religion like bid'at does. So bid'at is, it can be called an innovation or a heresy or this kind of thing which is put into the religion, which was not in the religion prior to that. So just to explain, the halal and the haram and the mustahab and the makruh, you know, the things that are obligatory, the things that are forbidden, the things that are recommended, the things that are prohibited, better not to do, the things that are neutral, you know, what thing is pure, tahir, what thing is najis, what is impure, all these things cannot be changed. These are fixed. Now, you have something which are these negative bid'ats, and of course, these are things which are included in the religion, which were not in the religion prior to that, you know, and these kind of things are very detrimental. And here, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says that nothing destroys religion like bid'at does. So these innovations which are put into religion, and whether good or bad, they are said to be a part of religion. When they are not a part of religion, this will destroy religion. It seems like a very complicated thing, but I think that as we explained it, it is actually quite simple. The words of the divinely appointed Imam, and so this is dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Text of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-sati. As-salamu alayka ayyuha al-badr al-tali.
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
تنها در برابر خدا تواضع میکنه، در برابر خلق خدا همچون مخلوق خدایان تواضع میکنه.
امام علی علیه السلام was the most humble person before Allah. Not only he showed humbleness before Allah, but also he was humble before the people. He was humble before Prophet Muhammad. He used to say, I am one of the servants of Prophet Muhammad. He was also humble before Lady Fatima al-Zahra.
در برابر فاطمه زهرا متواضع است. در برابر بچه یتیم متواضع.
Beside Lady Fatima, he was also humble before the orphans, destitute, and the needy people. Now compare Imam Ali alayhi salam with us, who sometimes show respect for the wealthy and powerful people and boast before the needy and poor ones. Even in our personal parties and gatherings, we show different levels of humbleness towards the people based on their status and money. However, Imam Ali alayhi salam was pious before Allah and was humble before his good people on earth. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
When the term de-dollarization was coined, there was a concrete idea behind it, that the U.S. currency would be uncrowned someday. And when we talk about the U.S. decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and the end of dollar hegemony in the world. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the U.S. military and financial bullying. So efforts are underway to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, Brazil and Argentina are reportedly set to start work on creating a currency union that would eventually involve other nations on the continent. Brazil and Argentina plan to create a common currency, the Financial Times has reported recently, citing officials. The plan will be discussed and officially announced at a summit in Buenos Aires, according to the report. Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa told the news outlet there will be a decision to start studying the parameters needed for a common currency, which includes everything from fiscal issues to the size of the economy and the role of central banks. According to Massa, other Latin American nations will be invited to join the common currency project. Brazil is proposing calling the new currency SOR, which translates as South. Massa noted the creation of the SOR is likely to take years, pointing to the fact that it took Europe 35 years to create the euro. It would be a study of mechanisms for trade integration. I don't want to create any false expectations. It's the first step on a long road which Latin America must travel, he said. Other officials who spoke to the news outlet said the new currency is expected to boost regional trade and help cut the country's reliance on the U.S. dollar. Brazil and Argentina have discussed the idea of a common currency for several years, but Brazil's central bank previously blocked efforts to get such an initiative off the ground, sources told the Financial Times. The two countries boast the largest economies in South America. Brazil is a member of the BRICS group and has enjoyed relative economic stability in recent years, although analysts point to a number of headwinds that could dampen growth this year. Argentina, meanwhile, has been plagued by economic instability for decades. The country has defaulted on its debt several times, most recently in 2020, and has had to resort to capital controls to protect its currency. Inflation in the country is currently soaring, and it has a roughly $40 billion debt to the IMF. Meanwhile, modern diplomacy had an eye on this issue. The de-dollarization, writing the West's primary point of concern, should be Russia and China's recent commitment to de-dollarize their transactions and establish a financial bubble immune to Western sanctions, notes the national interest. There is a tendency in the West to discount Russian projects that supply the country with enough funds to make it to the next month but cannot realistically last for an extended period of time. The problem with this mindset, though, is that Russia has no intention of reverting back to its participation in the U.S.-led international system, since it is convinced that China holds the future. Just as Putin demanded that European companies pay for Russian oil and gas in rubles or gold at the beginning of the year, he has also pressed Chinese energy firms to pay for gas in ruble or yuan. Russian banks have begun issuing checking and savings accounts in Chinese yuan. Russian Finance Minister Anton Silonov said during an interview, purchases of currencies of unfriendly countries, primarily dollars and euros, are now impossible. For us, these currencies are toxic. When asked why Russian assets in dollars and euros are still accumulating abroad if Moscow intends to dissolve all links to these currencies, Solonov maintained that Russia is in the process of abandoning them before adding a curious line. The only options that remain for Russia are ruble, a currency that we trust, or imports that are of our interest. Moscow has made its greatest strides toward de-dollarization domestically, however, and this initiative is inextricable from its coercive natural resource diplomacy. For instance, major fuel and oil companies are planning to increase the use of yuan in their operations. Reports say in August 2022, Russians bought a record number of the Chinese currency after Beijing doubled the yuan ruble trading band in March to provide more flexibility in currency exchanges. Putin said that Russia will not give up the dollar but will instead dramatically reduce its shares.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Uh, We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws concerning the different types of water according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohajad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about different types of water and their Islamic laws about them according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it valid to perform wudu or to use the water collected from the vapor of boiling salty water?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that, you know, water is divided into two kinds. One is adulterated water and the other is unadulterated water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the water which is collected from the vapor of boiling salty water can be called unadulterated water in common view, then the Shari'i rules of unadulterated water will apply to it. And it means that this water can be considered purifying. It purifies things. Because in common view, it's not considered to be water mixed with something. The water is taken from boiling salty water. And that vapor should be, water which has been collected in the form of water should be purifying because it's not mixed with anything. And therefore, the rules of unadulterated water will definitely apply to it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, What about Ghaleel water? If you make wudu with the Ghaleel water, the little water, is your wudu valid?
Sure. Ghaleel water is as purifying as cool water, and it is as purifying as any other type of water, as long as the water is unadulterated, it's unmixed. Because we know for sure that mixed water cannot purify anything, no matter how much the quantity. Even if a big tanker of mixed water is there, mm-hmm. it cannot purify anything.
Right.
Because it's mixed. It's just like grapefruit. It's the juice of melon, you know, or any fruit. Even if it's diluted and it looks like water, but then it cannot purify things because it is mixed.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Zawid, you know, in order to purify the bottom of the foot, or your foot, for example, my shoes or my foot, you know, if something, you know, by walking, for example, attached or is attached to the bottom of my foot, for example, or my shoes, which we consider as, you know, impure, najis.
Yes.
Do we have to, like, walk for, which we call it, 15 steps, all right? And after removing that najis material, that impure substance,
yes.
Should we consider my foot or my shoes pure?
Mm-hmm.
Or what? Like, for example, what do you call it? If it is still there after 15 steps,
the najis in
the najis substance is still there, attached, for example, to my shoes. Do we have to consider my shoes pure?
Well, that is not the case. It's not true to say that the najis substance is there and you consider your shoes as pure. No. It is basically it is necessary that the najis substance is removed, and there is no impure substance left on your shoe, and then of course you walk for 10 steps. You can walk 10 steps. You know this. There is some scholars and some religious authorities have said that okay, the individual should walk 15 steps. But that's not the opinion of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says that if you walk, let's say, 10 steps on a dry and pure ground, provided that the inherently najis substance is removed, then 10 steps are enough to purify things.
10 or not 15?
10 steps are enough, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So it's not necessary to walk.
So the stipulation is that the najis stuff is not there.
It's not there, and it should the sole of your shoes and the sole of your foot is considered to be pure in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Zawid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the different types of water and their Islamic laws, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Zawid, we all know that, you know, before the break, I asked you a question about the earth as a purifying agent when you said you walk for 10 steps. And as long as there is nothing impure attached to you, to your soul, the sole of your foot or the shoes, then we consider the shoes or the foot pure.
Yes.
Well, but the thing is, what type of earth are we talking about? Like, because some parts of the cities are paved.
You're right.
All right. Either with processed stuff such as mosaics or asphalt. Do we have to like walk on like a pure soil of the earth, mm-hmm. or it's enough to walk for 15 or for 10 steps on the asphalt or mosaics?
Well, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says in his Ajwibatul Istiftaat that when the bottom of one's shoes or soles of feet become najis as mm-hmm. a result of walking on the ground, they are purified by walking almost 10 steps on a dry and pure ground. If the inherently najis substance or the made najis object is removed from it by walking on the ground or rubbing it against the ground, you know. And he does not say that that the paved road or the paved ground or the metalled surface of the ground does not purify things. He says in his answer to the to a similar question,
mm-hmm.
that the sole of your foot or the soles of your shoes become pure even if you walk on, for example, on a road paved with asphalt. It's still made pure.
Mm-hmm. Another question, Sheikh Javed, because we all know that again one of the other purifying agents is the sun.
Yes.
Basically, the sunlight. Yes. When we say it's sun, is the sunlight considered one of the purifying agents? If so, what are the conditions for it to be considered as a purifying agent?
The truth of the matter is that sun does not purify all things. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you have clothes which are najis, or your shoes are najis, or there are other objects which are najis, they are not made pure by the sun. The sun purifies the ground and all immovable objects, not movable, immovable objects, such as, for example, trees, plants, buildings, and whatever is fixed inside them, you know, like, for example, timbers, doors, and so on and so forth. So these things are purified by sunshine, provided that at first the inherently najis substance is removed. It's always a condition, it's always necessary that the najisul ayn, or the inherently najis thing, is removed first. And as long as there is an essentially impure thing visible and can on the ground or on the door or on the wall of your house, the sun does not purify those things. So first of all, that impure substance should be removed. And then, of course, the thing should be wet, and it should be dried out just by sunshine. You know, it's very important to note that the thing which is impure, first of all, it should be wet, and then it should be dried out, made dry through the sunshine or the rays of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And not with anything like, for example, if a wind blows against it and it's made dry, or if there is, for example, a burning fire, you know, fire burning close to the najis area, and the wall becomes, like giving the example of a wall, if the wall becomes dry as a result of the fire burning close to it, so that thing does not become pure. So it's necessary and important to understand that sunshine should be direct, and mm-hmm. the najis part, which is wet, should be dried out through the direct sunshine or the light of sun. And that's when you can consider the sunshine as a purifying agent.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Thank you very much for listening to us. to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we talked about different types of water, as well as some of the other purifying agents such as the sunlight and the earth in this episode. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
United States and yet again another shooting with mass fatalities. Around a dozen people were killed and about the same number were injured in a mass shooting in the largely Asian city of Monterey in Southern California. Eyewitnesses said the assailant opened fire indiscriminately with a semi-automatic weapon at an event in Monterey Park as the local community was celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year. Captain Andrew Mayer of L.A. Sheriff's Department said officers had responded to emergency calls at around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday and found people pouring out of the premises. He said the officers made entry to the location and located additional victims. Police say the victims were transported to numerous local hospitals and were listed in various conditions from stable to critical. Witnesses said there was a shooter with a machine gun who had multiple rounds of ammunition on him so he could reload. It is still unknown whether the suspect knew his victims or whether it was a targeted attack. Investigations are underway into the shooting to find out the motive behind it and whether or not the incident was a hate crime. But the factors that lead to tragedies like the one in Monterey Park are deeply ingrained in U.S. politics, culture, and law. As defined by the Gun Violence Archive, a mass shooting is an incident during which four or more people are shot. The Monterey incident is the 33rd such mass shooting that has taken place in the U.S. already since the beginning of this year. It follows shootings at an MLK Day celebration in Fort Pierce, Florida, and a shooting that killed six people in Goshen, California, on that very same day. The Monterey shooting also follows numerous such events last year, including at a Walmart in Virginia, the one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a shooting on a school bus allegedly targeting members of the University of Virginia football team, and a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, last summer. The United States experienced 647 mass shootings last year. illustrating the severity of the issue with guns. The mass shootings in the U.S. come as no other country has suffered such a high death toll from gun violence. Every day, more than 110 Americans die at the end of a gun, including suicides and homicides, an average of more than 40,000 per year. In 2020 alone, more than 45,000 Americans died at the end of a gun, whether by homicide or suicide, more than any other year on record. In terms of the number of incidents, since 2009, there has been an annual average of 19 shootings in which at least 4 people are killed. The U.S. gun homicide rate is as much as 26 times that of other high-income countries. Its gun suicide rate is nearly 12 times higher. This, as gun control opponents have typically framed the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. as a symptom of a broader mental health crisis. Every country has people with mental health issues and extremists. Those problems aren't unique. What is unique in the U.S.'s expansive view of civilian gun ownership, ingrained in politics, in culture, and in the law since the nation's founding, and a national political process that has so far proved incapable of changing that norm. In terms of the number of guns in the U.S. and how they contribute to the related violence, one estimate from the Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 390 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, or about 120.5 firearms per 100 residents. More recent data also suggests that gun ownership grew significantly over the last several years. One study published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in February found that 7.5 million U.S. adults, just under 3% of the population, became first new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021. But what are the causes of gun violence in the U.S.? Easy access to firearms, a lack of comprehensive background checks and regulations, social and economic factors such as poverty, racism, and mental illness could be named as such. When it comes to the National Rifle Association, the NRA lobbies heavily against all forms of gun control and argues that more guns make the country safer. Despite years of financial woes and internal strife, the NRA remains the most powerful gun lobby in the United States, with a substantial budget to influence members of Congress on gun policy. In January, the NRA filed for bankruptcy as part of a fraud case against some of its own senior staff. Over the last several election cycles, the NRA and other organizations have consistently spent more on pro-gun rights messaging than their rivals in the gun control lobby. Who supports gun control? Despite widespread and vocal public outrage, often in the wake of gun violence, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014, according to polling by Gallup. 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. 11% surveyed said laws should be made less strict. Last year, Congress reached a deal on limited gun reforms for the first time in nearly 30 years, but the recent shootings underscored just how embedded gun violence is in the U.S. To the solutions. Some argue for stricter gun control laws, such as universal background checks, banning certain types of weapons, and increasing funding for mental health services. Others argue for a more permissive approach, such as loosening restrictions on gun ownership and emphasizing the importance of the Second Amendment.
Fractures are appearing in the Ukraine conflict between the Western backers of the war, first amongst themselves, than with Ukraine, even though some 50 nations agreed to provide Kiev with billions of dollars worth of military hardware, including armored vehicle and munitions needed to push back Russian forces, Germany has refused to provide Ukraine with Leopard tanks. Not only that, it has prevented other nations from transferring these tanks to Ukraine by countries that have them in their possession. The new German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said that despite heightened expectations, we still cannot say when a decision will be taken and what the decision will be when it comes to the Leopard tanks. This has angered Ukraine, which blasted the global indecision of its allies after Germany's refusal. A Ukrainian presidential advisor tweeted, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people. Every day of delay is the death of Ukrainians. Think faster." It appears that the main disagreement lies between the U.S. and Germany, which has indicated that it would agree to do so only if the U.S. provided its Abrams tanks as well. Washington has said providing its Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. This disagreement has led to friction within the circle of U.S. congressmen. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has called on both countries to supply the machines. To the Germans, he said send the tanks to Ukraine because they need them. It is in your national interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin loses in Ukraine. To the U.S. President Joe Biden administration, he said send American tanks so that others will follow our lead. Military assistance to Ukraine has continued unabated in recent weeks and months. The headline reads, "Europe is gearing up to send Western tanks to Ukraine." It almost sounds like the warring parties are just getting warmed up to the conflict, that the war has entered a new phase. One conclusion could be that Ukraine is losing the war on the ground since it continues to seek more military assistance, and what it has received so far has not been enough to defeat the Russian forces. This, however, will not deter NATO and a number of individual member states who have pledged to provide heavier weapons to Ukraine. U.S.'s cautious stance may be that it does not want to fall into a direct conflict with Russia. That could also mean that it may risk defeat or that this risks getting into a nuclear confrontation. Russia's reaction to countries that are going to provide Ukraine with tanks was a warning. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, has said Kiev's foreign backers do not care about Ukrainian lives and are motivated by their desire to hurt Russia. Those tanks can burn and will burn like the rest of the weapons. The nations supplying them are using Ukraine as an instrument in achieving their anti-Russian goals. Russia has also stated that this is no longer a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between Russia and U.S. and NATO. But what the Ukrainian defense minister said has been very telling. He tweeted recently, "We are carrying out NATO's mission today. They aren't shedding their blood. We are shedding ours. That's why they are required to supply us with weapons." All that brings everyone to the question, when will Ukrainians realize their country is being sacrificed for the sake of the U.S. weakening Russia?
Zamir Kabulov, Russia's presidential envoy to Afghanistan, says that the U.S. has been reaching out to the Taliban's opposition groups, such as Daesh, and secretly giving money to them. He describes the reasoning for this covert support as such: because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace isn't established in this troubled land. He further linked this move to Russia's security by saying, "With the armed opposition in Afghanistan, the Anglo-Saxons are covertly sponsoring Daesh, who are aimed at undermining not only the stability of our Central Asian partners, but also the security of Russia." Allegations of the U.S. supporting Daesh in particular have been around for a decade at this point. Sometimes they even come from U.S. officials.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. He's the founder. He founded. say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is among the top officials that accused the United States of backing Daesh. Erdogan made the accusations in response to U.S. accusations against his government for supporting terrorist groups. He said, "Now they give support to terrorist groups including Daesh, YPG, PYD. It is very clear. We have confirmed evidence with pictures, photos, and videos." In a three-year field study into the supply chain of Daesh, it was found that the arming and external funding that anti-Assad rebel groups received from the U.S. found their way into the hands of Daesh. With all the accusations on America's direct involvement in the founding of Daesh, the indirect involvement that most of the world agrees resulted in the creation of the terror group is the quote-unquote power vacuum that the U.S. left in the region by fighting the many wars it fought, especially the invasion of Iraq and the support of Syrian rebel groups. The U.S. effectively fought a war in Afghanistan for 20 years with a budget of over $2.1 trillion to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. The Taliban has been accused of many things since their swift power grab back in August of 2021, but what they have managed to do is stabilizing the country and ridding it of power struggles. That means groups like Daesh, who still have a presence in the region, weren't able to establish bases in Afghanistan, despite still carrying out terrorist attacks for a while after Taliban's takeover, the number of which have significantly dropped over the last year. Now, with around 97% of the population of Afghanistan below poverty line, and with half of the country's billions of dollars worth of foreign assets frozen by the U.S., the last thing the country can afford is U.S. shenanigans trying to prop up Takfiri terrorist groups there. Recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken poured salt on the wounds of Afghanistan by justifying the way the U.S. left Afghanistan by saying, if the forces had remained there, quote, "it would have, I think, made much more complicated the support that we've been able to give and that others have been able to give Ukraine." Almost as if Afghanistan was a pawn in the grand scheme of U.S.'s political agendas, an attitude that isn't too uncommon in U.S. politics with all of their friends and foes. Instances of such attitude are numerous, from the promise of retaliation to Saudi Arabia over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and then doing nothing about it because Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner to the U.S., to using Taiwan as a means to get under China's skin that could lead to a conflict wherein Taiwan will turn into a pawn for U.S.'s political games.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has held a press briefing to give an update on the ongoing war in Ukraine. In his press briefing, which was held in Moscow on Wednesday, Lavrov accused Ukraine's foreign policy of being under the dictation of Western nations. The Russian top diplomat further noted that Western nations have yet to make, quote, serious proposals to Russia on how the conflict should be resolved. Lavrov added that Russia was willing to support a draft truce proposed by Ukraine in late March, but the proposal was destroyed by Ukraine's Western supporters. He also said, in reality, the West decides for Ukraine what its foreign policy should be. Western officials have repeatedly claimed that arming Ukraine would help it achieve a better negotiation position and that no talks with Russia should take place before this happens. Lavrov further said Moscow would react to any serious proposal for overcoming the crisis that come from the US and its allies, but none has been sent so far. He also added that the West is using Ukraine to destroy the security system that existed in Euro-Atlantic for many years. Lavrov's comments come amid deepening crisis in Ukraine. On Wednesday, a helicopter crash killed Ukraine's interior minister, his deputy, and the state secretary of the ministry. The deaths have been described as a huge blow for Ukraine. The United States and its Western allies are also ramping up their support for Ukraine. Reports say Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, met for a couple of hours with Ukraine's chief military officer, General Valery Zaluzhny, in Poland. This is the first face-to-face talks between them since the war began in February 2022. The meetings are expected to focus on Ukraine's ongoing and future military needs. The United Kingdom has also pledged a squadron of its Challenger tanks, but it has too few to form the basis of a Ukrainian force. The moves by the United States and the UK come amid an apparent rift in the anti-Russia coalition.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. Some of that is non-military aid, some of that is, you know, the likes of humanitarian support such as generators, some of that is obviously military hardware, some of it is training. We train 10,000 we trained Ukrainians in the UK, and we'll train another 20,000 in the UK, and some of it is effectively backfilling British stock.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has named Boris Pistorius as the country's new defence minister at a time of mounting pressure on Berlin from Western allies to allow Ukraine to use German-made tanks in the war with Russia. However, Germany says when it comes to sending tanks to Ukraine, Berlin is still waiting for the US to take the lead.
And this is the strategy we have, that we are strategically interlocked together with our friends and partners, that we are working together with them, that we are discussing with them, and that we are never doing something just by ourselves, but together with others, especially the United States, which are very important in this common task to defend the Ukrainian independence and sovereignty.
Germany is under pressure to participate in a broader alliance of countries that will supply Ukraine's army with modern Leopard 2 battle tanks. The previous German defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, was a loyal defender of Chancellor Scholz's cautious tank stance. Analysts said the delay so far has to do with disagreements amongst Western countries about the lethality of the weapons Ukraine needed. Russia has denounced the Western weapons supplies. Officials say Ukraine's allies were using the country as a tool to achieve their anti-Russian goals. Kremlin says the tanks that the UK pledged will burn just like the rest.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only